This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Jim Webb, the junior senator from Virginia. Webb was elected in 2006 and soon after got a lot of attention for delivering the Democratic response to President Bush's 2007 State of the Union address. Webb will become the senior senator from Virginia in 2009 with the retirement of Senator John Warner. Webb currently sits on the Senate Committees on Foreign Relations, Armed Services, and Veterans Affairs. He's one of the people being talked about as a possible vice presidential candidate on the Democratic ticket. Webb has described himself as a Reagan Democrat. He served in the Reagan administration as Assistant Secretary of Defense and Secretary of the Navy. He's one of four men currently in the Senate who fought in Vietnam. Webb was a Marine Company commander. He's also the author of six novels. His new book is part memoir, part political analysis. It's called A Time to Fight: Reclaiming a Just and Fair America. Senator Webb, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's start with the veterans bill that you co-sponsored to increase the benefits of soldiers serving in Iraq and Afghanistan to the equivalent of what they were for World War II veterans. Give us a brief overview of why you wanted this to be your first piece of legislation when you were elected to the Senate and what you hope to accomplish with it.
Well, this benefit arguably should have been in place before I arrived at the Senate, and I had been thinking about that even before I decided to run, that the present Montgomery GI Bill for the people who are serving was designed in the 1980s as a recruiting incentive for peacetime military people, and it's not a reward for service or a transitional benefit that is the equivalent of what these people have earned and what they need in order to readjust back to civilian life after they have served. So what I decided to do is a very simple concept. People keep talking about how much they appreciate the service of everyone who's been stepping forward since 9/11. We ought to give them the same shot at a first-class future that we gave the people who came back from World War II. When people came back from World War II, we paid for their tuition, we bought their books, and we gave them a monthly stipend. And so I designed this legislation to do that. So now we have a very comprehensive, fair bill that will be the approximate equivalent of what people received when they came back from World War II. We got 58 sponsors in the Senate, more than 300 sponsors in the House of Representatives, and we need to get this done this year.
John McCain and Lindsey Graham are two sponsors of an alternate veterans bill, and they say, you know, and critics of your bill say that the financial incentive should be going to keep the volunteers in the military. They say that your bill, after 3 years, maximizes the benefits, and that would mean that a lot of people would have an incentive to leave the service after 3 years and cash in on the benefits. So what's your response to that?
They're not looking at reality. You know, no one wants to interrupt the retention of people who desire to make the military a career. I grew up in the military. My dad made the military a career. But the reality is that by the time our soldiers in the Army and our Marines have finished their first enlistment, 70% of those in the Marine Corps have left, 75% of those in the Army have left the Army, and we're not taking care of those people. There are a lot of people in this country who come into the military not because they want to make it a career, but because they want to honor a family tradition, serve their country, to do a hitch, and then move on. And given the operational tempo here, we have a strong duty to make sure that they have a proper readjustment benefit and a good shot at a first-class future. It is a totally separate question from the way that this has been portrayed by Senator Graham and some others. And with respect to retention inside the military, that other group, the 25% of the Army and the 30% of the Marine Corps who at least reenlist for another term, if not making it a career, The military itself is doing a really good job managing benefits packages for those folks. I don't think this GI Bill is going to affect retention. What it will do is it will expand the pool of people that Department of Defense is trying to reach for recruiting in the first place.
You know, President Bush has made it clear he would veto the bill if it passes. Do you think there's any chance you can override it?
If President Bush vetoes this legislation in the form that we have it, he will become the first president in history to veto a benefits package for veterans. So I would say to this president that he has a very clear choice here. He has said that this is the new greatest generation. He doesn't seem to have a problem when we've pushed them so hard that many of them are spending more time in Iraq and Afghanistan than they are at home. He doesn't seem to have a problem when we are stop-lossing a lot of these people, not letting them leave the military after their enlistment is complete. He doesn't have a problem putting those kinds of demands on these people, and he should think twice before he keeps them from having the kind of benefit that can allow them to have the future they deserve.
At a ceremony in 2006 in which President Bush was shaking the hands of new lawmakers, you refused to shake his hand at the ceremony. Why?
That's not true.
That's not true. That's what I'd read.
What happened was after about a week after the election, and if you'll recall, this was one of the most vicious negative election campaigns probably in history, and certainly in the history of Virginia. There were a lot of raw emotions in the air, and they brought, during an orientation period for new senators, they brought us to the White House. Someone came over it was a beginning of a reception. There was no receiving line, by the way, so there was no situation there where we were supposed to go through and say hello and shake the president's hand. When I was in the room, a White House aide came over and asked if I wanted to have my picture taken with the president, and I declined. I did it gracefully, but I declined. And then after a speech, the president came up to me, and he said some things to me, and I said some things to him. And let's just say that we both had a bad day.
Were these the things when he asked about your son in Iraq?
It was a little more complicated than that. I think I don't need to go through this again. But the best thing that was said about this was written by Peggy Noonan in the Wall Street Journal when she said that there was a discourtesy in that exchange, but it wasn't from me. At the same time, look, I have done everything I can to patch that up in the right sort of way. Without backing away from my own views during the incident. When my son returned from Iraq, I was invited to go over to a meeting in the White House on national security issues, and I called the president's liaison to the Senate, who I've known for a long time, and I said he wanted to know about my son. Well, I'd like him to meet my son. And so I brought my son to the White House while I was going to one of these meetings. We all said hello. We got a picture taken, and end of story.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Senator Jim Webb, Democratic senator from Virginia. He has a new book called A Time to Fight, Reclaiming a Fair and Just America. You were, in the Reagan administration, the first ever Assistant Secretary of Defense for Reserve Affairs, and you oversaw the National Guard and the reserve programs. I read that the National Guard has only about 60% of its equipment because the rest of it is overseas. Are you concerned about the National Guard's ability to protect Americans against either natural disaster or a terrorist attack?
Well, the first thing to say is that when I was running the National Guard programs in the 1980s, no one expected that they would be used for such extensive deployments and repeated deployments as they have been since 9/11. So it has put a great burden on the National Guard and the Reserve. The second thing that I would say is that in terms of equipment, you're seeing difficulties across the board on the active services as well as the Guard and the Reserve because of the continuous operational environment and the way that that degrades your equipment and in many cases because of combat actions and other accidents, you know, causes it to be destroyed. So the equipment issue is one that cuts across a lot of different areas. And then the third thing that I would say is that one of the reasons that I put this new GI Bill in is that I wanted to modify the entitlement provisions for the GI Bill to expand the eligibility for these Guard and Reserve people so that they also can join in getting a better future.
You know, we talked about your new GI Bill that you introduced. You also introduced a bill that failed to require congressional approval before any military action in Iran. Do you think the Bush administration is considering a military strike against Iran before President Bush leaves office?
Well, it certainly seems that it's on the table, that there are people in the administration who would like to see that happen. The legislation that I introduced basically said that any unilateral action against Iran could not be justified by the congressional authority that was given in 2002 to take military action against Iraq, that it should be considered as a separate issue and as a result should come to the Congress properly as a function of the constitutional responsibilities of the Congress. I also introduced a bill, by the way, on dwell time, going to this issue of how hard our troops have been pushed in these deployments, basically saying you can't send anybody back until they've had at least as long at home as they were previously deployed. And the historical ratio has always been 2-1. I've spent all of my life around the military one way or the other, including 5 years in the Pentagon. And what we are doing to these young people right now is going to have some real downstream impact on their lives if we don't step forward and take care of them right.
In your book, A Time to Fight, you say that you think the career military has been politicized along party lines, despite having prided itself on its apolitical posture through American history. Explain what you mean.
The United States military traditionally has stayed out of overt politics, the active duty military. When I was growing up in the military, my father was a career military man. He would never even tell me who he voted for. Now, I could sometimes try to figure it out because he was a very opinionated man, but he said it was his duty as a military officer to keep that separate, that it was his duty to be serving the political system, and so that shouldn't be on the table. Today, because of a complicated series of events that began with the attacks on the military during the Vietnam War, the military has become more overtly politicized along party lines than ever before in our history. The United States military today in its career officer ranks is probably 8-1 Republican. And I think when they're overt as they are, it's not particularly healthy for us.
Yeah, you write that your father and his military friends felt betrayed by the Democrats because of the naive yet arrogant way that McNamara, the Secretary of Defense then, and his whiz kids ignored military advice as they conducted the war in Vietnam. And you say now you think the Republican Party has populated the Defense Department with a cast of unseemly true believers who propelled America into an unnecessary and strategically unsound war. So do you think that the military itself has become politicized in a way that it hasn't been before?
The active duty military is much more overt in its political participation than it ever has been at any other time in my life. And as I said, part of that is because of the unwarranted attacks on the integrity of the military culture during the Vietnam War, which goes beyond your quote about McNamara. It's fair to say that the Democratic Party went from being the anti-war party to being the anti-military party for a very long time. And it lost a lot of people. It lost a lot of veterans, not just active duty military people. But what has happened since 9/11 in terms of the perspectives on the use of military force and the best way to show an affirmative respect for those who served, it's started to turn around the other way.
Does this describe in a way why you switched parties? You served as a Republican in the Reagan administration, Secretary of the Navy, and in 2006 you ran and won as a Democrat representing Virginia in
Well, I'm basically a Reagan Democrat. I was never involved in organized political party politics, ever. I was invited to run as a Republican for the United States Senate in 1988 when I resigned as Secretary of the Navy. I was asked to run by the Republican Senate Campaign Committee. I declined. A year later, I helped the United Mine Workers in their landmark strike down in Southwest Virginia against the Pittston Coal Company, which is not a very traditional Republican venture. But there are a lot of people like myself who grew up with instincts that were more aligned with the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party up until the 1970s was the party of the working person more than anything else. It was the party of the working person in this country. And when the Democratic Party in the 1970s moved so virulently anti-war and against the people who had served, a lot of them, not the whole party, but a lot of the party activists moved in that direction, and into interest group politics more than working people politics, it lost a lot of people. And Ronald Reagan was able to bring a lot of those people over to his side, people who wanted a strong national defense and other sorts of things. So I was very proud to work in the Reagan administration. But what you saw over a period of time was the Republican Party moving into an odd coalition between the sort of the monarchists at the top and the people from this other group, the Reagan Democrats and others, who over time simply became manipulated by these emotional issues. And Karl Rove became the sort of the master at this, finding these divisive emotional issues that had nothing to do with economic well-being, really. You know the issues as well as I do.
Just so we're on the same page, happened, the issues you're talking about was what? Gay marriage,
you know,
gay
God,
rights.
Guns, guts, gays, abortion, and the flag.
Right.
So I think a lot of people who had made that migration and were not really naturally aligned with the Republican Party in terms of economic fairness and issues of social justice kind of had a hard time, and particularly after 9/11 when the Bush administration made such incredible strategic blunders in moving into Iraq and how they dealt with international terrorism, and when their ability to manage even your most basic crises like the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, people just started saying, you know something? They don't have anything over there. And I finally said, well, I think that it's time for me to step up and do something about the health of our country rather than sitting back and complaining about it. And if I were to run, then I should run as a Democrat, which is sort of where I began when I was a young man, and try to bring some strength and health back into the Democratic Party.
You think the Democratic Party should be emphasizing economic inequities and trying to get a better deal for working people, for the middle class. And you're critical of people within the Democratic Party who want to emphasize things like global warming and the environment. You think that's a more difficult—
I don't think that's a fair thing to say.
I'm not
critical of them because they want to emphasize that. What I'm saying is there are people who believe that you can build a party's platform around those issues, and the data shows otherwise. They're important issues. I think I say it three or four times in the book. But the gut issue that is going to bring people back to the Democratic Party is having the courage to address the enormous disparities in income that have evolved over the last 20 years. When I graduated from college, the average corporate CEO made 20 times what the average worker makes. Today, the average corporate CEO makes 400 times what the average worker makes. And that's only happening in the United States. In Japan, the number is, I think, 10 times. In Germany, I think it's 11. So we have a situation here where the people who are doing the hard work of society are seeing their way of life recede, and they need an advocate. My family has a tradition of military service, and I said many times when my son went, which obviously was a very difficult period in the middle of running for office when everyone is trying to get me to personalize my feelings about the war based on my son. But our family's always served. And I'm proud of him for stepping forward to serve. And I don't think his views about Iraq were any different than mine.
You say in your book that when you went to Vietnam in 1968, your father, a military man, was getting disillusioned with the war in Vietnam. Did his disillusionment affect your response to serving in Vietnam?
No, because it's basically the same premise that in our family, for many generations, when there's a war, we've followed a citizen-soldier tradition. And the most important thing that I could do when I went into the Marine Corps was to provide the kind of leadership that was expected in order to lead people who were being sent into harm's way. And that's not politics. That's exactly what we've been talking about. The military, particularly at that level in the military, you're implementing your country's policy. And the war wasn't going to go away, no matter what I thought of it, and just as the Iraq War wasn't going to go away in any short period of time, no matter what my son thought about it.
You were opposed to the war in Iraq before it even, you know, there was even official discussion of it. You were asked to write an op-ed for the Wall Street Journal. And on September 12th, you wrote that an op-ed that was never published in the Wall Street Journal, in which you warned, "Do not occupy territory. We already have terrain to defend, the U.S. and our outposts overseas. And we cannot afford to expand this territory in a manner that would simply give the enemy more targets." What made you think on September 11th that the Bush administration might be heading toward occupying territory?
I've been working on military strategy and military policy since I was 17 years old. The first book I wrote when I was 28 years old was a book on national strategy. With respect to the Middle East, I was a journalist in Beirut in 1983. I saw how difficult it is to articulate your national policy when you're on the ground in the middle of a five-sided long historical argument. I warned against the tilt toward Iraq in 1987 when I was Secretary of the Navy, when during the Iran-Iraq War, when we, through a kind of weird series of events, tilted toward Iraq, I warned against going into Baghdad in Gulf War I, all for the same reasons, that the United States should not be an occupying power in that part of the world. It's just too volatile. There are too many agendas that are, you know, take over one after another. And on 9/11, when I immediately started seeing some of the rhetoric on the other side, I sensed that just as in Gulf War I, this might turn into a push to invade Iraq. And I thought with everything that we needed to do and still need to do in terms of bringing the world along with us on the war against international terrorism, that we should not be moving into Iraq.
When you ran for the Senate in 2006, you ran against George Allen. And George Allen had, his campaign had leaked to the Drudge Report, to Matt Drudge, excerpts of your novels out of context. And then Drudge accused you of being a pornographer and a pedophile. When you won the election, you called on President Bush to denounce Rovian tactics. And I'll read your description of the tactics from your book. "Damaging an opponent's reputation is more important than contradicting him on the issues. Hit the other candidate where he's perceived to be strong. Cancel out his positive. Sow the seeds of doubt." I don't think President Bush ever renounced Karl Rove's tactics. Are you concerned that those tactics are just becoming part of the American political playbook, that both sides are starting to use them?
I think that those kinds of tactics are threatening to destroy the environment in which government is supposed to function, because campaigns become so vicious that it's very hard to reach out and work across the aisle after they're over. And also, I think that from what I'm hearing, you're probably going to see more of it rather than less, which is unfortunate. I've seen John McCain stand up and say that he does not want to see these sorts of tactics in the campaign, but you saw George Bush sort of say those same words too. And politics is it's a contact sport. There's to be expected a lot of give and take, but the politics of deliberate personal destruction are, I think, keeping a lot of good people from stepping forward and running.
My guest is Democratic Senator Jim Webb from Virginia. He served as Secretary of the Navy in the Reagan administration. He opposed the war in Iraq from the start and introduced a bill to expand GI benefits. He's written several novels and nonfiction books. His new book is called A Time to Fight, Reclaiming a Just and Fair America. You know, you're in an interesting position as a politician now, because you've been a writer. I mean, your first novel was published in 1978. You've written several novels and nonfiction books. And as a novelist, you sometimes write about the darker sides of life. In fact, you write in your book, "My curiosities have taken me down some rather strange alleyways to some of the darker, meaner corners of the world. And in that respect, when it comes to examining any of the issues of the day, I've brought to the Senate a different set of experiences from my colleagues." So let me start by asking you, why have you wanted to explore those darker, meaner corners of the world?
Well, why shouldn't I?
Sure.
The duty of a novelist, depending on what you write about, or the duty of a writer, is to render to your audience things that perhaps they haven't seen, in order to examine the human condition, in order to help illuminate their understanding of how we should live our lives, and how they are living their lives, and how they might be having to live their life if they weren't tucked up reading a book in some comfortable place in a safe country. So the great writers in history, in my view, have been the ones who have gone out and actually lived. I remember when I was in school, I had a mandatory engineering degree at the Naval Academy, but we're allowed to pick a minor. And I took literature as my minor, and I started reading the people that I thought were the greats, people like Steinbeck and Hemingway and Faulkner. And one of the things that really jumped out at me was how few of them had a real formal education. That if you know, if you were going to go get a PhD in literature, you basically become an expert on a theme or on a person. But if you're going to create, if you're going to write, you have to get out and experience life. But human conduct, how people live, I mean, that's always fascinated me since I was a kid. I moved so many times. I moved 30 times by the time I finished college. And how cultures interact, how they define value systems among themselves, how, you know, what standard of living that they have. These are the kind of things that we don't see enough of anymore in novels.
You know, I think for novelists, it's just kind of understood the part of what you're doing is exploring the dark recesses of the heart and the dark things that people do and think. But in politics, you're not supposed to be going there. You know, and it's going to be used against you in some way, in a way that it wouldn't for a novelist that wasn't in politics.
Well, I think what happened in my campaign is an example of that. Fields of Fire is widely regarded as the classic novel of the Vietnam War. It was the most taught piece of literature, American literature, in college courses on Vietnam for many years, and yet you can pull four or five sentences and mischaracterize that as some erotic novel, et cetera, et cetera. You can pull three sentences out of the Bible and characterize it as an erotic book. So to your point, what you see is that if you have lived a life that is not along the normal, normally accepted career pathways, then you're obviously going to have these kinds of bombs thrown at you.
I'm not sure how many of our listeners have read your novel, so I thought I'd ask you to read the first paragraph of Chapter 1 from Fields of Fire, which is a novel largely set in Vietnam. This is your first novel, isn't it, from 1978?
Right.
Would you just read the opening paragraph for us?
Okay. This is about a character named Snake getting ready to roll a heroin addict who has staggered into a men's room, or maybe it's a woman's room, that he's cleaning when he's working at a theater. And this is stream of consciousness from Snake's perspective, where he says, "There he went again. Smackman came unfocused in the middle of a word, the unformed syllable, a dribble of bubbly spit along his chin, and leaned forward, that sudden rush of ecstasy so slow and deep it put him out. His knees bent just a little, and he stood there, motionless, styled out in a violet suit and turquoise high-heeled shoes. He had the wave, and his hair was so perfectly frozen into place that he seemed a mimic sculpture of himself, standing there all still with skag."
I mean, I think that's pretty good writing. And let me just ask you, that expression, styled out, I hadn't heard that before. Is that like an expression that you came up with, or is that an expression that was used then?
That was an expression. The thing about every dialect in Fields of Fire, it's probably eight different ones, is very correct to the different cultural groups and to the time. You know, getting styled out was a term back then.
And having written about this character who's a heroin addict, having been exposed to that and thought about it as a novelist, has that affected your political views about how we should handle drugs and drug addicts compared to how we are doing it?
Well, I started working when I was 12 years old. I had a lot of different jobs. I've been in a lot of different environments, moving around. I think I've been in and out of as many different cultural and professional areas as just about anyone in this country. And all of those experiences and the friends and associates that I've made inform how I look at political issues. I'm a bottom-up politician in a sense that I view the well-being of this country from the bottom up. And so there are basic fairness issues that come to my mind that perhaps you don't see as often as with some others. I don't want to judge others. And I think that our incarceration system in this country right now is just totally out of kilter. I also say that, by the way, having been the first American journalist that I've ever heard of that was able to get inside the Japanese prison system 25 years ago. I spent a month going through the Japanese prison system, and at that time, I think they had a country half our size, and they had 40,000 people in jail. We had 780,000 at that time. We now have 2.38 million people in jail. We're doing something wrong here. And I as much as anyone, I want to lock bad people up and go after the excesses that we have in terms of particularly gang activity in our country. But the way we've approached some of these other issues, I think, is not healthy to our society. I've held hearings on it in the Joint Economic Committee. I'm holding another hearing in June, specifically on the issue of drugs in America. And I think we need to try to find answers.
Just give us one example of what you'd like to change in terms of how the judicial system treats drugs now.
Well, I think we're locking way too many people up for possession. We've got good numbers on that in the book. I think we need to move toward drugs courts. I think we need to come to the realization that drug addiction itself isn't a crime any more than alcoholism is a crime. It's a problem that we need to approach and we need to solve. And so there's a whole universe of issues that have to be addressed before I would come up and say, this is exactly the way that I want to go with it in terms of imprisonment. But we are on the wrong track. I think we need to agree on that.
My guest is Senator Jim Webb, Democrat from Virginia. His new book is called A Time to Fight, Reclaiming a Fair and Just America. A lot of people are talking, as you know, that you're a possible contender for the vice presidential running mate in the Democratic Party. So I know you've said that if you were asked, it would be a mistake. It's not something you want to do. But if you were asked, would you accept?
Well, you know, I think this is... this is something people are having a lot of fun with a lot of people other than myself, you know, the vice presidential sweepstakes seem to be the next logical step after the nominations are secured. But I like what I'm doing in the Senate. I really haven't had a minute to think about this other stuff. I haven't had a conversation with Barack Obama or with Hillary Clinton on anything like that. And my political prototype, the way that I, in terms of recent experience anyway, is Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who is able to combine an intellectual career with a government career. And I'm principally a writer. That's one reason that I decided to go ahead and write this book, is that one of the great contributions I think I can make in terms of how to solve our problems is sitting down and participating in the votes and the rest of it, but trying to show the nuance and the sort of concerns that should propel us into action. And the Senate is a good place to do that.
You know, it's interesting with all the things you've done in your career from, you know, fighting in Vietnam, being Secretary of the Navy, heading the National Guard and the Reserves, being a senator, you still consider yourself primarily a writer. Is that just like your orientation? Do you know what I'm saying? Like some people are just...
They're writers. There's part of their mind
that's always standing back and describing something.
Well, I'd never thought that when I was young that I would end up as a writer. But I think that my career really has been in writing, and writing defines me. The process of writing is the same analytical process that I use in making decisions in the Senate. That's one reason, for instance, when you ask me about drugs and incarceration, I'm able to take, because there's six-year terms in the Senate as opposed to 2 years in the House, I'm able to take some of these complex issues and deal with them the same way you do as a writer, which is you think about them, you interview people, you take your time in terms of coming to a conclusion, but then when you write it, you know you have to live with it. And so I basically am, in my persona, a writer, somebody who likes to think deeply and then, you know, go on the record in a as clear a way as I can.
You're a superdelegate, but you haven't endorsed anybody yet. Will you before the primaries end? I don't see anything useful.
I declined to endorse basically out of my respect for both of the candidates. I think that they both could be strong presidents, and I think they both could be elected. So once I declined to endorse in Virginia, I just believe that both of these candidates have put so much time, effort, money into making their case out there to the American people that out of respect, I'm just not going to endorse until the primaries are over.
Well, Senator Webb, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Jim Webb is a Democratic senator from Virginia. His new book is called A Time to Fight, Reclaiming a Just and Fair America. When primetime television was interrupted by the writer's strike, our TV critic, David Bianculli, filled the time by watching classic and recent series on DVD. Now that the strike is over, he's still doing the same thing.
Viewing levels for most primetime broadcast TV series have dropped significantly since the writer's strike began. And it's no mystery why. When favorite shows disappeared, audiences turned elsewhere, to cable, to the internet, even to DVD. And once you begin digging deeply into what's out there on home video, there's almost no reason to come up for air. Lately, I have been indulging specific passions and entertaining myself by programming my own sort of themed TV festivals. My latest kick? Shows from England. Some of them are DVD releases of programs that have been televised here already. Like State of Play, the perfect, amazingly exciting miniseries drama that was one of 2003's TV highlights. It's out on DVD now from BBC Video, and its story of political intrigue, mysterious deaths, and persistent journalists is a nonstop thriller. David Morrissey and Bill Nighy star, and it's now being remade into an American movie. But watch the original now. Its depiction of a modern newspaper newsroom is better than anything I've seen on TV. Better than the last season of The Wire, and even better than Lou Grant. Other DVD sets of programs that have been shown in America already include the massive BBC Natural History Collection, a whopper of a set that features four nature documentary series hosted by Sir David Attenborough. Planet Earth is here, and The Blue Planet, and The Life of Mammals, and a particular favorite, The Life of Birds. Then, from Acorn Media, there's Suburban Shootout, a sort of a comedy cross between The Sopranos and Desperate Housewives. That was shown on cable's Oxygen Network, and it too is being remade with an American spin. But the original is just fine, thanks. But as a TV critic, I'm most excited about the stuff that has never been televised here in the States, and which gives us glimpses of favorite performers at previous points in their career. And here's where I'm thrilled to say that if you're a fan of Hugh Laurie or of Helen Mirren, you're really in luck. Hugh Laurie is on view in another Acorn Media release, 40-something, which he made in 2003, just before crossing the Atlantic to star in House for Fox. It's a six-part, six-hour comedy series in which he plays Paul, a guy with a midlife crisis. His wife basically ignores him. His grown sons are having a lot more sex than he is. And everything Paul touches seems to go wrong. In this scene, the parents of one of his son's girlfriends show up unannounced, while the young woman in question is having sex upstairs with another of Paul's sons. It's a farcical situation that reminds me a lot of Fawlty Towers, just as Laurie's portrayal reminds me a lot of John Cleese.
So, what's the problem?
The problem is your other son, Daniel.
We have grown very fond of Rory. Rory is a gentleman, but Daniel...
Oh, we think he may be toying with Laura's affections.
Oh, I doubt that very much.
What's that noise?
Hot water pipes. Bloody nuisance. Why don't we go through to the kitchen?
And then, finally, there's the mother load. Helen Mirren at the BBC, a BBC Video collection of nine TV productions, all featuring Mirren, from 1974 to 1982. Almost all of them are brand new to U.S. viewers, and just watching Helen Mirren grow as an actress here is a thrill. In the first TV play, 1974's The Changeling, she's dressed and made up like a royal tart. And she plays one, too, using her feminine wiles to persuade a detested underling to commit murder on her behalf. In 1975's The Apple Cart, based on the play by George Bernard Shaw, she's a sexy, saucy mistress with a tongue as sharp as her wardrobe. And so it goes, from playing the devoted mistress of Benito Mussolini in 1975's Caesar and Claretta, to the innocent bride in 1977's The Country Wife. But the most precious jewel of all here is something that is an unusual, delicate treasure. Blue Remembered Hills, a daring 1979 teleplay by Dennis Potter. Potter, who wrote Pennies from Heaven and The Singing Detective, is my favorite TV writer of all time. In this play, he remembers his childhood friends and fantasies in England's remote forest of Dean, and shows both the charm and cruelty of childhood by having adult actors playing the children's roles. The adults are playing at acting children, just as the children they're playing are playing at acting adults. As in this scene, when Helen Mirren, as Angela, puts her baby doll into its pretend crib while other friends watch and join in.
Put your nightie on, and I'm going to give you a new nappy. And then I'm going to put you to bed. So you've got to go to sleep now. And don't you wake me up. I've given you your supper. You've had your supper. Just be a good girl and go to sleep.
No. Go to sleep, Dinah.
Oh, you are a naughty, naughty, naughty little bubby.
Smack her one in the chops, Angela. That'll keep her quiet.
No. No, you can't do that. No smacking. Not in my house.
There. Mummy is with you then.
Weird? Sure. Different? Unquestionably. Fascinating? To me, absolutely. And that's why, when regular TV lets me down, imported TV on DVD brings me right back up.
David Bianculli is TV critic for Broadcasting and Cable Magazine and for TVWorthWatching.com.